This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. For many Americans, the war in Chechnya is just one more ethnic conflict too confusing to pay much attention to. My guest David Remnick wrote an article in last week's New Yorker that puts the conflict into focus. Remnick was in Chechnya in May. He's the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book about Russia, Lenin's Tomb. About 30,000 people have died in the Chechen War. There's a shaky ceasefire in effect. Peace talks are scheduled to resume on Saturday. The Chechen Republic decided to break away from Russia in 1991 after the dissolution of the Soviet Union. Determined to crush the rebels, Russian troops invaded last December and turned the capital of Grozny into what Remnick describes as a slaughterhouse. He says the destruction of the city was appalling and utterly senseless. I asked him to describe what Grozny looks like now.
The way it looked to me was no different than the pictures I've seen of, say, downtown Dresden or Stalingrad or Berlin after the war. It is utterly and completely destroyed in the central part of the city. It's a shocking sight.
How many people are left in the city?
Well, there was some warning that there would be a war, of course, and tens of thousands of people left the city. It was a city with a population of 400,000. I think there's about 100,000 people in the city now, maybe more at this point. Some people are coming back. The bombing is long over. There's still sniper fire, still some skirmishes, but the bulk of the war, the heaviest part of the war, of course, is finished.
You compare in the article you wrote for The New Yorker the amount of shelling in Sarajevo and in Grozny, and you say at the height of the shelling in Sarajevo, there were 3,500 detonations a day. In Grozny in the winter, at the peak of the war, there were 4,000 an hour.
Yeah, I gave that statistic not in any way to denigrate or to poo-poo the calamity of Sarajevo and Bosnia, which is the real shame of our time, or at least the shame of our American-European time. But I did want to give some sense just how intense the bombing was in the winter, just how brutal the attack directed from the Kremlin on its own city, after all, really was. This again, Sarajevo, large parts of it stand, or there's many damaged parts. There's many buildings with lots of damage. Many, many people have been killed. But the intensity of the war in a short period of time in which 30,000 people were killed, mainly in those 2 months, January, February, is just astonishing. And I should say that the way of the world and the way our memories work and the way our focus on news works is that it's the habit of Americans and most other people to be able to concentrate on one foreign story at most at a time. And I think most Americans are still having a hard time wrapping their heads around the confusions and complexities of the war in Bosnia. So the war in Chechnya, while well covered in the press, never really penetrated, so far as I can tell, our consciousness in some way.
Well, you write that the destruction of Grozny is appalling, utterly senseless. I think a lot of us are very confused about why it happened in the first place. I'm hoping you can help us understand what this war has been about. What are the official reasons that President Yeltsin gave for the attack on Grozny?
Well, there's a series of reasons. The background is this. In 1991, in August of 1991, of course, there was a coup, an unsuccessful coup against Mikhail Gorbachev. At that time, beginning at that time and even before, in various regions around the Soviet Union, central authority was falling apart. And that tendency was encouraged, either ignored or encouraged by the Kremlin. Once it became clear that Gorbachev's power had almost completely diminished and that Yeltsin was de facto in charge, and then, of course, he was, in fact, the undisputed leader of Russia after December 1991. Now, what happened was a Chechen Air Force general named Joker Dudayev returned from his station in Estonia after the collapse of the Soviet Union shortly there before, and he became a politician who exploited very artfully the twin causes of Islamic nationalism and Chechen independence being a cause for hundreds of years. You can read about it in the stories of Tolstoy and Lermontov and the poems of Pushkin. You can read about it in the tragic history of the way Stalin oppressed the Chechens in the 40s. But Chechen independence became something radically different from some of the other independence movements around the country and around Russia. It also became a center of organized crime. It no longer paid any taxes into the central budget. Dudayev was an uncommonly criminal leader, although certainly we shouldn't overlook the fact that Moscow itself is riddled with organized crime. That is the background of it. We shouldn't think that in Chechnya in any way resembled the sort of sweet save the whales atmosphere of the Baltics in the late 80s.
Yeltsin called Chechnya an outlaw state, a criminal state. How much of a center for organized crime has Chechnya become, and how much of a reason do you think that really is for the attack on Chechnya?
Well, I'd call it a pretext rather than a reason. I mean, you wouldn't sanction the United States Army bombing Brooklyn and Queens in order to get rid of the Gambino family. It's rather insane. But on the other hand, you don't want to deny the criminality of the mafia itself. The mafia itself in Chechnya went all through the government, and it really became what one of Yeltsin's aides called, legitimately, a free economic slash criminal zone. It was the one area or one of the few areas in Russia where flights could come in from abroad carrying all sorts of contraband, in which customs officials were completely bribed and allowed it to go on. It was an area of the country in which the so-called Vazdushniki, the air people, so-called because they seem to have gotten their money from the thin air, made billions of dollars through bank frauds in conjunction with corrupt officials in Moscow. There were all kinds of criminal scams involving the vast oil supplies and oil refinement industry in Grozny. A lot of people were getting very rich, so much so that when you go around in Chechnya, you'd be shocked to find, especially if you have, like me, lived in the Soviet Union or former Soviet Union for 4 years, see houses that look like a kind of further vulgarization of the houses in Beverly Hills. I mean, these kind of very ornate and fantastic huge houses. I mean, you'd never see this in most other parts of the country.
But you say that the connection of Chechnya to organized crime was just a pretext for Yeltsin. What do you think the real reasons were for the war?
Politics and power. I think that certainly there was a terrible situation evolving in Chechnya that had been evolving that way since 1991. It had been all but ignored by the Central Russian government because, after all, the Central Russian government had its attention focused on other things, quite legitimately, economic reform, political reform, the battle with the White House, the 1993 uprising. I mean, various political crises that kind of make our political crises look tiny by comparison. So it evolved and it was ignored, and Chechnya was recalcitrant, and Yeltsin refused to negotiate with Dudayev and vice versa. And it just reached a critical point. And the critical point came at a time when Yeltsin's own abilities had deteriorated for reasons of health or drinking or what have you. And he was surrounded by the most reactionary ministers, sounds familiar from 1991, a la Gorbachev, and they pushed Yeltsin toward war, the brink of war, and Yeltsin acquiesced. He did it, and he bears the terrible responsibility of a war on his own people.
Did the people who were encouraging Yeltsin think that this would establish the power of Yeltsin's administration and the new Russian state?
Well, precisely. They thought it would be quick and easy. They didn't think it would be a 30,000 people dead. They thought it could be accomplished, in the famous words of the defense minister, in 2 hours by one paratroop regiment. And they also thought that it would be very popular on the populist level, because Chechens are extremely unpopular among Russians. And the reason is that Chechens, for one reason or another, have the image as a mafia people. And when you hear people complaining in Moscow about the mafia, very often the reference will be to those Chechens. Well, of course, it's not true. All ethnic groups are involved in the mafia in one way or another throughout Russia. But this is the ethnic group that's despised above all, more than Jews, more than Azerbaijanis, more than anyone else.
The Chechnya is primarily a Muslim state. How much do you think that figured into the calculations of Yeltsin?
Well, I think that was a factor that was exploited by Yeltsin. We kept hearing about mercenary fighters coming in from Turkey or Afghanistan, and this, for the most part, was rubbish. I don't think it was a major factor. It was a means to isolate Chechnya, I think. But you should remember that that Dudayev was exploiting this kind of Islamic nationalism in his own land, and he himself knew next to nothing about his own religion. When he was interviewed by someone from the Los Angeles Times, he said very self-confidently, you know, Muslims pray three times a day. And the reporter from the LA Times said, you know, I think it's five times a day. And Dudayev said, well, the more the merrier.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Remnick, and he's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. His report from Chechnya was published in last week's edition of the magazine. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. David Remnick is my guest, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. He recently returned from Chechnya. He won a Pulitzer Prize in 1993 for his book Lenin's Tomb. So you say that Yeltsin's aides reassured Yeltsin that winning in Chechnya would be easy. This would be quick, and he'd be out. Well, that was a grave miscalculation. You spoke to some military leaders in Russia. What did you learn was responsible for the miscalculation?
Well, that the miscalculation was political, and the political miscalculation and hastiness led to a disastrously planned military operation. Let me explain, if I can. What happened was the so-called power ministers told Yeltsin the time to act was now, meaning late November and then into early December. He signed a secret decree in late November, and military planning began in high secrecy, unbeknownst to even the top military leadership in many of the services. And nobody seemed to want to lead this operation because they all knew it would be a disaster if it would be carried out so quickly. Remember, December in southern Russia is a time of high fog, terrible mud, and all the rest. Remember how long it took us to plan the American operation in Iraq. It took weeks and weeks and weeks of open planning, transporting of military equipment and troops. This was done all, for the most part, out in the open, and at the same time, military plans and options were being drawn up. You cannot, in the words of the military editor at Sivodnya newspaper, Pavel Felgenhauer, you cannot, as Yeltsin thinks, order up a military operation the way you call up and order a limousine. It cannot be done effectively. But this is precisely what he did. And all of a sudden, the tanks began invading Grozny, and they were being shot by what amounted to Chechen guerrilla units. And the Russians suffered terrible losses in the beginning of the war, to their astonishment. As the war went along, of course, the superior manpower, the superior equipment of the Russian army prevailed. But this war, although a victory ultimately for the Russian army, cannot be called a success in any way, politically, militarily, socially, or in terms of public opinion.
You talked to a general who resigned over the war in Chechnya, a Russian general, and he said that the planning was so bad that tanks were sent into the city without maps of the city.
Yeah, precisely. You had tank drivers who were told to go into the city. They didn't know where they were going. They were expecting backup that never came. They were expecting air cover that never arrived. And they found themselves trapped. And in many cases, the operation ended in their own destruction and their own death. And this was not an exception. This was the pattern in the beginning of the war.
David Remnick is my guest staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. His report from Chechnya was published in last week's edition. What are the state of the on-again, off-again peace talks now between Chechnya and Russia?
On-again, off-again. Right. They just fumble along, and God knows what will happen there. I'm sure the resolution will be some sort of increased autonomy, but no independence for Chechnya, and probably a fairly considerable continuing military presence in Chechnya.
In your New Yorker article, you wrote, "The rubble in Grozny is a fair representation of what's become of Yeltsin's promise of democratic reform."
Well, I think it may even be a fairer representation of what's become of Boris Yeltsin's political prospects. Someone in the article, one of Yeltsin's more liberal aides, is quoted as saying he doesn't expect Yeltsin to run in the presidential election in 1996. I not only think that's probably true, I also really hope that it's true. I think that Boris Yeltsin has done extraordinary service to his country prior to this. He was an important figure to follow Gorbachev. He went where Gorbachev really could not after Gorbachev's own triumphs. He was a remarkable politician at a time of crisis in 1991, did a lot to shatter the monolith of the Communist Party. And I think he's done a tremendous amount to reform the economy of post-Soviet Russia, despite its difficulties, despite its ups and downs. I think in many ways that's a success story. But in terms of his handling of Chechnya, in terms of his ability to form a kind of stable political democracy in Russia, I think he has hit the wall, and it's time.
Yeltsin's health has not been good. Uh-huh. If Yeltsin was out of commission or if he died, do you think that there'd be an abrupt policy change on Chechnya?
No. It's over. The Chechen War is over. Grozny is defeated. The villages are defeated. The Chechen army is depleted and is down to just kind of a core of living and faithful. The only policy at this point is the policy of settlement, and there'll be, as I said before, there'll probably be some kind of rough accommodation of a degree of sovereignty and a degree of military occupation. If Yeltsin were to disappear from the scene, his prime minister, Viktor Chernomyrdin, would take over, and I think one of the triumphs of sort of nascent Russian democracy is that I do not think there would be a terrible crisis if he died.
What is the strategic advantage for Russia to hold on to Chechnya?
Lots and lots of oil. You know, it's a landlocked piece of land. It's in the foothills and in the mountains of the Caucasus. This is a traditional area of war for the Russian czars and general secretaries, and now it's democratically elected president. There's lots of oil there. And there's also a principle in big quote marks, the principle being the Russian government, the Russian leadership's political need to set down a marker in terms of self-assertion, in terms of Russian identity. And it's a message to other regions that independence movements of any kind will not be tolerated in their extreme.
David Remnick is my guest, staff writer for The New Yorker. His report from Chechnya was published in last week's edition. I want to switch the focus to Bosnia now. Russia is the only member of the contact group, the allies, including the United States, France, England, Germany. It's the only member of that group that has staunchly opposed the use of military force against the Bosnian Serbs. And I wonder if you see that position as connecting at all to the war in Chechnya. And I guess that connects to another question I'd like to hear your answer to, which is that do you think what Yeltsin has done in Chechnya is at all comparable to what the Bosnian Serbs have been doing?
To the second question, I don't think it's roughly the same. There's brutality involved and so on. But I think the reasons for Russia's behavior vis-a-vis the situation in Bosnia is related to their purposes in Chechnya, and that is that after the fall of the Soviet Union, appeared this new entity, Russia. What in God's name is Russia? Well, at first, in 1991, 1992, there was talk of dreams of Russia being a kind of European democracy founded upon the principles of Jefferson or what have you, French constitutionalism, what have you. Well, it turns out that wasn't a very popular idea. Not only was Western aid not forthcoming in any large way, Russians became disgusted with the idea of Russia being a country that would just follow in the footsteps of the United States and Europe to form its self-identity. Identity being the operative word here. That's the most important thing. Russia simply just did not want to follow, and it saw itself following in terms of disarmament, following in terms of policy in the Middle East, becoming a very, very junior partner in almost every situation in the world. And there arose, after the December 1993 elections, the appearance of a very strong, very vocal, pro-nationalist wing of Russian politics, embodied by, in an almost comic and scary way, by Vladimir Zhirinovsky. It became absolutely untenable for the Russian politicians to simply be seen as following all the time. And so on. In the situation of Bosnia, they can feel that they cannot be seen to sanction the bombing of the warring against a Slavic brethren, meaning the Serbs. And so I think that's the source of that policy. It's deeply rooted in domestic politics and deeply rooted in the politics of identity.
Well, David Remnick, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
David Remnick's report on Chechnya is published in the July 24th issue of The New Yorker. He's also the author of the book Lenin's Tomb. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.